So we've now done the first three of the Four Noble Truths. And so today we start on the fourth Noble Truth. And the Three Noble Truths are one of the central teachings of the Buddha, of Buddhism. And if you understand very well the Four Noble Truths, it creates a very strong foundation for understanding the rest of what Buddhism has to teach. Both the things that are fairly easy to understand in Buddhism, but also some of the great subtleties in Buddhist philosophy and metaphysics, understood a lot better if you understand thoroughly the Four Noble Truths. And they are the understanding of suffering in the world and in ourselves, the understanding of the causes of suffering in ourselves and in the world, and the understanding that there's a possibility of release, of freedom, of cessation, of ending suffering and becoming free or finding peace and happiness. And then there's the fourth Noble Truth, which is a Noble Truth of the path of practice that can help actualize fully the Four Noble Truths. And it's said that the Four Noble Truths are very easy to understand, kind of, you know, intellectually. But the idea for a practitioner is to penetrate them, is usually the word, or to embody them, is to make them become, to personalize them, to really make them saturate through our body and mind. So they become us, in a sense, so we really understand intimately what they're all about. And so Buddhism has a whole slew of practices to help us do that. Most of them are awareness practices, because to understand the Four Noble Truths takes a lot of awareness, the awareness of our circumstances, of ourselves, and what goes on within us and the world around us. So the fourth Noble Truth is called the Truth of the Eightfold Path. So these are the ways in which we can support our practice, the ways in which express our practice, they're the ways in which we can help us do this deep work of penetrating the Four Noble Truths and making them personal rather than just intellectual. You would think that, in a sense, the first three Noble Truths are enough in themselves. If we really understand suffering well and the causes and the release of suffering, and then you can live happily, then what's the need of the other Eightfold Path? I believe that it's not so easy to penetrate deeply into the causes of suffering, that the conditionings we have in us, the deep latent fears and worries and anxieties we have, are very, very difficult to see. And even if we can see them, it's very difficult to see them deeply enough and clearly enough so that they self-release, so that we're no longer caught by them or in their grips of them or confused by them. And so the Buddha then offered the Eightfold Path as a way to support practice in order to kind of clarify and see clearly the first three Noble Truths. When a person's insight is very deep, when a person is very present to what's going on for them in the moment, it's said that the Four Noble Truths, those four appear simultaneously. It isn't that you have to kind of figure it out and analyze, you know, what is this now, and this is, you know, the first and the second, and this is the third, and this is the fourth, or whatever. But rather we see very clearly all four simultaneously. It's like when you're in a situation and you find yourself uncomfortable, say that, I was in the supermarket doing my grocery shopping before coming here. I was wondering whether I was going to get here in time. So I was suffering. And in the moment of seeing, you know, a little bit of anxiety there, I could see the suffering. I could see the cause of the suffering was I wasn't so concerned about getting, you know, finishing the shopping. I was concerned about getting here. I was attached. I was holding on to my ideas and feelings about what it means to get here. And because of my concerns around that, I started getting a little bit anxious in the market. And I could see very easily at the same time, you know, this is kind of a silly thing to be anxious about, maybe. And I could see, you know, the possibility of being free of that and being happy was right at hand, because I actually went into the market quite happy. It wasn't like so such a distant event. I was feeling in really good mood going into the market. And it wasn't when I realized that I was kind of running out of time that I got anxious. So I could see, you know, all these three were very clear. And then I could see that there was something I could do to help me become freer, more at ease in that situation. And that situation was just a matter of reflecting with all that. And it just seeing all that, just suddenly I felt more at ease, this clear seeing. But I could have, for example, have thought, well, maybe what I need to do is to investigate more deeply and understand more deeply what's going on in this suffering. Or maybe what I need to do is to reflect on how to live my life properly in such a way that I don't end up rushing so much all the time, rushing ahead of myself, so I never can really see what's going on in my life. So I can never catch up. So I'm always blinded to what my holdings, my cravings, my fears are, because I'm always reaching ahead for the next moment. So I'll explore how I live my life, right livelihood, or right action, or speech, right speech. We explore all these things. And so the Noble Eightfold Path is made up of right understanding or right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The word right maybe is a little bit funny word, because it sounds like then you could have wrong. I don't think that's what's meant. I don't know what it's meant. But anyway, the word is samma in Pali, and it's usually translated into English as right. Appropriate, helpful. I like the word helpful. Helpful views, helpful action. That action that helps us. So then the next few weeks I'll talk about each of these. And the first one then is right view. In talking about the Eightfold Path and each of the different elements of the path, there are traditionally two ways of understanding it. And to introduce these two, I thought I'd mention first, maybe hopefully not to complicate it all too much, that once the Buddha offered what was called one of the shortest definitions that he had for what he had to teach, what his teachings were. And the shortest definition in the Pali version of it is to avoid all evil, to do all good, and to purify the mind. To avoid all evil, to do all good, and to purify the mind. This was kind of the essence of the Buddhist, what he had to teach. What's very interesting, this is a footnote to it all, is that in Mahayana Buddhism, they changed that formula slightly. And what the Mahayana Buddhists say is the essence of Buddhist teachings, is to avoid all evil, to do all good, and to save all beings. So the difference is between purifying your mind and purifying and saving all beings. And I would like to believe that the two are the same. And one of the ways I've tried to talk about a little bit the Four Noble Truths is to stress that in the wording of the Four Noble Truths, there's nothing that says in it, you're supposed to look only at your suffering. It's a call. It's a request, it's a suggestion that we become aware of suffering in the world, wherever we tend to encounter it, and understand it deeply and well. The Buddha didn't say, you know, the first noble truth is your suffering, you know, or the first noble truth is just my suffering, or whatever. It's just suffering, wherever it is. And so this idea of purifying the mind and saving all beings, being connected with all beings, I hope it's the same thing. So he talked about these three. Now these three can be seen from two points of view. The first, do all evil, to avoid all evil and do all good, is more the karmic side. To purify the mind is the religious side, is the spiritual side of the teaching. And so when we look at right view, you can look at it either from the karmic side, or from the spiritual side, or the side of becoming free. From the side of karma, karma kind of means consequences, actions and consequences. That one of the very important things that we can do in our life, very helpful in our life, is to understand that our actions, the ways we talk, the ways we act, have consequences in our life, our well-being, and consequences in the world around us. And so, the right view is, from this point of view, is understanding the laws of consequence, realizing that if you get angry at someone, that personally you might be reinforcing the tendencies, the habits of mind for you to get angry again. And you're creating maybe devastation around you and causing pain around you. Just see the consequence of that, to understand that, and then to let our actions and the way we live our life come out of understanding what consequences our choices have. So right view is beginning to looking at consequences and looking at them carefully. And in doing that, part of that is to create the conditions, with spiritual conditions, the conditions of the heart, so that our attention, our awareness, can be more attentive and more present. So our awareness is not scattered, our awareness is not confused or preoccupied by other things, or clamped down in some preoccupation. But so our awareness and our presence in some ways freed, so we can see clearly what is actually here right now. So we live our life so that the consequence of the way we live helps us to become more present and aware and awake and compassionate. So we can study our life. What are the ways in which we can live our life that can help that? I could get to the supermarket a little bit earlier. You know, and so I can be a little more leisurely there, so I don't get all caught up, to a very mundane example. I was at, it was really something, you know, suffering, you know, so we don't understand suffering. I find sometimes we don't notice our own suffering. Sometimes, you know, we notice it plenty enough. We say, I've noticed enough now for the last few lifetimes. But sometimes we simply don't notice it because we're in a hurry or whatever. So the other day I was up at the San Francisco Zen Center for a ceremony. And when I go to Zen Center for ceremonies, I put on my robes. And so I have this Buddhist robe that I wear. And when you wear the Buddhist robe is kind of like represents the Buddha, represents Buddhism, the commitment of practice. It's a wonderfully symbolic object that you put on, you actually wear this beautiful symbol. And so I put on this beautiful symbol of my commitment to practice and to Buddhism and awakening and field of compassion that it represents. And we had this wonderful ceremony. At the end of the ceremony, there was going to be a reception. And but those people have, who are priests, who have these kinds of Buddhist robes, they don't want to wear this Buddhist robe, so precious, at the reception with their tea and cookies and stuff, where you might get it all dirty. So you want to take it off. So we have to go upstairs to take it off, and then you go downstairs again to the dining room where you can have the reception. Well, it took me a while because people wanted to talk to me to get back upstairs where I could change. By the time I came up to the room to change, I was all there by myself. And it was getting late, and I wanted to see people before they left. And so I started rushing. And I started rushing to take off Buddha's robe. And I was kind of in a hurry. And in my hurry, I didn't realize that being in a hurry was painful. I didn't realize that I was actually suffering. And here, what in the world was I doing suffering? Here I was wearing, you know, this wonderful symbol of practice and waking up and living a life that's a little bit saner. And I got caught by the idea of rushing down. And I realized at that moment that how, because I was hurrying, I wasn't really noticing the fact that I was uncomfortable, that I was anxious. So I wonder how often that is true for us, that we don't notice our anxiety. Anyway, so right view to viewing our life and the choices we make in our life from the point of view, does it help us to become more open-hearted, more compassionate? Does it help us to become more connected with ourselves, more compassionate with ourselves. Does it help us to become more present? And if we do that from the karmic point of view, our life actually becomes happier to some degree. It moves, it tends, it inclines our life towards happiness. But happiness is not necessarily the same as freedom. And to simply rearrange our life, rearrange the furniture, as they say, so that our life can be happier, more at ease, is not really the point of Buddhist practice. It's a very useful thing to do, and Buddhist practice can help us do that to some degree. But that can be an endless task, if that's our only point in life, is to try to arrange things so we can be a little bit happier, a little more at ease. Then what Buddhism wants to offer, or was suggesting, is it's possible for a radical different relationship to life, a radical different identity, a shift of identity, a shift of a relationship to the life around us. So we're not involved anymore, caught up anymore in the cycles of preoccupation with happiness and unhappiness. So, for example, what's a good example? Many of us want other people to like us. We want to be approved by them. We want their approval or whatever, right? So you're at work and you want the other people's approval around you for whatever you're doing. Say you want their approval for the way you dress. So you're concerned about the way, so you're very concerned, you spend the weekend, going to, what is it called, men's wardrobe? I saw an advertising, warehouse, they're taking over, aren't they? Men's warehouse, and you're kind of concerned about clothes and all that, and you're successful, and you get this really great suit, and people compliment you at work, and you get their approval and all this, and you feel happy, you've succeeded for a week. And then next weekend, I wore that suit, and now I have to figure out something else, so you succeed for another week. And then the next weekend, you can't go to men's warehouse anymore. And so you have to wear the same old suit over again. And then they notice, no one kind of thinks, oh, wonderful new suit you have. It's kind of old-fashioned, they say, This doesn't quite work around here. And then you feel depressed for the rest of the week until you can go shopping again. So it's possible to rearrange the circumstances so you're always happy, perhaps, by always getting a new suit. It's also possible not to give a shit. And not to have your well-being tied up with those kinds of conditions. Not to have your well-being, your happiness, related to conditions like that. What happens to most of us is our happiness and our well-being is completely tied up in the conditions of the world. Our identity is tied up in the conditions of the world. And the alternative, the religious step, or the spiritual step that Buddhism has to offer, is to step outside of tying ourselves up in those conditions. To step outside, placing our security, placing our well-being, placing our happiness in the conditions of the world. Rather to find a kind of trust in the world, trying to well-being in the world, that doesn't avoid the world, but rather is not tied to it, not caught by it, not preoccupied with it. So the wonderful T.S. Eliot quote that I mentioned last week, teach us to care and not to care. How to be in the world in a careful way, caring way, but at the same time, not care so much, not to tie our identity up in it. So right view, from this point of view, is sometimes said to be no view, not to have any view at all. Is it possible? It's not nearly maybe possible to live without any view at all. Any understanding, any stories about the world we live in. But no view, to have no view, is not to yoke our happiness, bind our happiness to a particular opinion, particular view, to to particular conditions in the world. So to have no view is to have a kind of very deep kind of trust or openness or ease, or I like the word trust a lot. The trust is so deep that even trust disappears. So there's just, you're just there. It's just you and the world around you, you and the conditions of your mind and your heart and your emotions, you and the conditions of the world and things happening. So things happen. The wonderful display of the mind, of the heart, of emotions and feelings, of the people around us. And we're kind of like the image that I had when I first started meditating was when I was a kid. I grew up, part of my upbringing was in Italy, in Trieste. And there were all these a lot of delightful old Italian men. You used to sit on park benches in the park with their canes between their legs, and they just sit there for hours. There they were, just watching the world go by. And there was something, for me, that seemed very deeply satisfying about the way these Italian men just seemed to be so at ease with themselves and content and present and aware that I hoped that I got old and I could sit in the park bench the same way. But maybe meditation is that. Or maybe that's what we can learn through mindfulness, is not to make ourselves different. Not to be sitting here huffing and puffing and trying to get concentrated or trying to do something, but rather sit there like old Italian men in the midst of our mind and our feelings and awareness and just, oh, this is what's going on. Being aware, this is what's going on, but like old Italian men. This is what's going on. But keeping up the persistent effort, the persistent wakefulness of, oh, this is what's happening now. But in that, just no view. Nothing to hold on to. Just the kaleidoscope of feelings, emotions, thoughts, experiences around us. So right view. Right view. When the Buddha talked about right view in his first sermon on turning the wheel of the Dharma, he defined right view as understanding the Four Noble Truths. So maybe I could have just said it simply by saying it that way. To understand really well the Four Noble Truths is right view from the spiritual point of view, from the spiritual dimension, what Buddhism has to offer. So that to understand suffering, to understand the causes of our suffering, to understand the possibility of freedom and release, and to be connected to the world from that openness that comes from release, and to understand how to live a life that supports that. To see that very directly, that is right view. And maybe that's all we need to say. And I think I've said this before, but I think this is very significant, that this is the Buddha's definition of right view, right spiritual view, because it's so simple and lacks metaphysics. It lacks theology. It lacks faith statements that cannot be proved. You don't have to have this fancy religious statement about, you know, cosmic consciousness or ultimate Godhead or the fundamental emptiness of all things and the groundlessness of all being or the non-duality of self and other or the non-duality of samsara and nirvana. You don't need all that. Because the danger with all that is that we use them as a view. And freedom doesn't come from a view. It doesn't come from separating ourselves from views exactly, but freedom is not in view. So the Buddha offers as a right view the very thing perhaps that can free us from all views. Isn't that great? Self-destructing views. So I'd like to hear from you now. We've started on the fourth noble truth, and you've heard about the first three over 3 weeks. And if the whole point of right view is to understand the four noble truths, I'd be curious to hear from you how you've understood what I've been saying, or how you understand the Four Noble Truths that we've been discussing so far. Yes?
Can you say something about trust and the sources of trust and what you're trusting
in? Oh, you're not trusting anything. The trust is so deep you don't have to trust in anything. There's not an object for your trust. Maybe it's to be have enough ease or feel secure enough in life that we don't need to have an identity, we don't need to have a belief system, we don't need to have certain conditions around us in order to us to be at ease, at peace in the world and with ourselves.
So are we trusting ourselves or are we trusting life?
You could say that. You can say you're trusting life or you're trusting the universe or you're trusting yourself. But I think that to do that really thoroughly, at some point you'll understand it's not really trusting anything. It's just trust. And if you want to call that trusting life, that's completely fine. But it's not anything that's reliable.
It's trusting the process.
You could say that also. That's a fine thing to say also. The process, what we learn to trust in mindfulness practice is we trust being mindful. The process of life that happens when we're mindful. But we don't want to be very careful not to make the trust, say we're trusting something, because anything that you trust is unreliable.
Unconditional acceptance.
Sorry?
Unconditional acceptance.
Unconditional acceptance. And one way to talk about all this is just that, unconditional acceptance. And the Four Noble Truths are pointing to how do we live with unconditional acceptance in our life? And how to do that in a way that's not naive, but how do we live with acceptance? Yes?
Do you have to trust anything, or do you simply know?
Sorry?
Do you have to trust anything, or do you simply know it as it is?
Well, in the end, you don't have to trust anything. You don't trust anything.
It's like the ocean.
Yeah.
The ocean is there. It's an object not to be trusted or mistrusted. It has no malice towards you. And anything, any personifications that you put on it come from you. It's simply there. And if you know it, then you know its dangers and its beauties and the full ramification of the ocean, the vastness of it. But you don't have to trust it. It's just there.
If you know how to float. So we're learning to float. In the world that we live in, and it's just, and if we float in the world, it's just there. We don't have to trust it. We don't have to trust anything. Pesha.
This is all fine, but how do you translate it into the corporate world?
Well, this is what I was trying to ask you guys. You keep asking me questions. So I've been talking, theory, for the last 4 weeks. So now I want to hear how have you understood it in your own life, the Four Noble Truths? No one's going to do it for you. You have to figure it out for yourself.
Well, I was trying out the third noble truth last week. I found myself creating a lot of concepts. The existence of pain, okay, noticing the part of me that objects to it, noticing that just about all of me objects to it. then having compassion on all of me while it's subjecting to the pain, remembering to give it that part of me that's objecting its own sense of being, its own, being there, set it free to do all the objecting it wants. And about this time, I think, I'm so hung up in thought, I've missed the point.
Yeah.
I no longer have a right view if I ever had one.
Yeah. So if I understand you well enough, we want to be very careful not to make this an analysis. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out the different steps and analyze, this is this, and therefore it must be this, and try to figure it out, and all that. That could be a fine thing to do, but we can get caught up in that. And that I believe more useful is to relax a little bit, and Try to understand the outermost layer of the suffering, the most direct, immediate experience you have, and your relationship to that. Just start with that. That's really simple. You do the simplest possible thing you can do. And if it gets too complicated, then relax. And relaxing might mean go for a walk or go meditate and let your mind and your body become a little bit quieter and not so fast and spinning around in thoughts or concepts. And when the mind is not spinning in concepts anymore and you can see more directly, you might understand more directly how this applies to your life. Because as I said, when the insight is there, the Four Noble Truths, all four of the Four Noble Truths are seen simultaneously. And if you find yourself thinking too actively about all this, you might easily lose your way.
I think sometimes people forget and they get hung up on their physical, and they think that's who they really are, and it's not. You're an observer. You really are observing all this. You get attached to the physical, and you get trapped in the other things. Rather than just observing what's happening and accepting it.
Sure. That's right. Yes?
It seems to me that the issue of trust is a way of asking the question I wanted to ask, which is, it seems to me it does require somewhat of a leap of faith to do what you're suggesting, which is when you're in pain and your mind is spinning and, you know, and stuck, and to trust that will pass, and not trying to analyze it, not trying to change it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one that I've had difficulty with since I started coming here, you know, first understanding but then doing it, which is not trying to change things when they're uncomfortable.
Right.
And that seems to me to involve a huge leap of faith.
Yes.
That it will pass, or it's supposed to be this way, or however you want to interpret it.
It can initially require a huge leap of faith. Hopefully it's not too huge, because if it's too huge, maybe it's blind faith. You're just trusting, you know, the teacher, or trusting the teaching or whatever too much. But if it's a small leap, that's fine. See. But at some point it becomes verified faith. You do it a little bit, and after a while you learn, oh yeah, this actually works, this is true. Yeah, this does pass. It's okay to be at ease with the discomfort, because it does pass. Or it's better to be at ease in it than it is to fight it. So a lot comes with experience. And if we bring mindfulness and awareness to our life, slowly we'll get more and more experience, and a lot of trust comes from that. But remember, maybe, you know, we can get caught up in this word trust. It's a really, for many of us, a hot word. Maybe, you know, you have to be a little bit careful that word doesn't become like a whole thing in itself, like God or emptiness or, you know, great metaphysical statements. We don't need to understand, you know, try to apply trust to our life so much as we need to try to understand the Four Noble Truths. So if life sucks and you're not accepting it and you're fighting it, that fighting it is suffering. And that suffering has a cause. You're holding on to the idea that life's supposed to be easy, for example. And if you can see that, then maybe you can see that it's possible to let go of that holding. And your life still would suck. Except, because nothing's changed, except you're not fighting it anymore. And so you're a little bit better off. Right? So that's really straightforward. That's taking the most obvious outer layers of it and just kind of finding your trust, finding your acceptance, finding the Four Noble Truths right there. And once you've done that and you stop fighting it, then you look again. And then you see, you know, it isn't just like life sucks. It's the fact that, you know, the battery in your car isn't working anymore very well. I mean, that's really what's preoccupying you the most. There's a lot of other things that are going on, but it's wet, it's raining, and the battery's not working. You wonder if the car will start. And so you get to look at that more carefully. But if you're fighting the whole world life sucks things in a generic kind of way, then you've created a impossible entity that is as impossible as God. You know, or some concept like that. So what we try to do is to try to take the package we're given and not fight it, and then begin looking, where is the next layer of where I'm attached, where I'm fighting, where I'm struggling, where I'm holding on. Looking at particulars. Yes?
I think it comes to a real love for reality and a dislike of things that are not genuine. And if you're seeing how a situation is going and all the things coming into it, this will give you the distance and the calmness to evaluate what's going on.
Thank you. That's beautiful. What was the expression you said in the beginning? A love of reality? One beautiful love of reality. Love of the way things are. One of the definitions of right view, this, you know, Buddhism has lots of definitions, is seeing things as they are. This is right view. But a love of reality, which means not being confused by the stories that we live in, the stories that we paint our reality with.
Sometimes mental effort is the deterrent. It's too much mental effort rather than just accepting what's there.
Yeah.
And harmonizing with it.
Acceptance is a great word. It's not the final word.
Acceptance but it's, approval just means
it's a great word. Sit here and accept, because a lot of what the second noble truth, the holding that's is there fundamentally because it's something we're not accepting, and because we don't accept something, there is clinging, there is holding on, and so the opposite of that would be acceptance. The release of the holding becomes the same thing as acceptance. But acceptance, as you said, doesn't mean approval or condoning.
But then you can deal with it.
But then you can deal with it much more realistically. Yes?
Ajahn Amaro said, just try to remember that everything belongs. And that's really helping me a lot in my daily work. And that, I may not like it, but it belongs.
Everything belongs. Yeah, that's also very true. I've probably said this enough here, but I like very much the English expression, the given. The given is given often means the obvious. It's given, it's the obvious, right? And whatever happens to us, even though it's terrible or bad, is in a sense the given. And once it's given, it's our choice how we relate to it. So everything belongs, and then we decide how we relate to it. Last one, Bill.
For me, it's not taking life personally. life and the people I meet and the whole of my existence is not neither out to get me, nor is it here to sort of make life wonderful for me. It's not my slave to bring me all these good things, nor is it out to get me. Most of what happens just happens. I find that most of the people who come in and are angry and upset generally are not angry and upset at me. A lot of times they're angry and upset at themselves. And a lot of times they're angry and upset at the person who cut them off on the car in front of them. So I had an experience several months ago when a woman came in and no one could do anything for her right. Everything that we did to try to service her in the business I'm in drove her absolutely crazy. Well, this was a woman who was in the middle of production, in the middle of her tech week, in the middle of one of the most difficult experiences any school teacher can go through. And I just sat there and I tried to explain to her what was going on and did the best I could by her and stayed absolutely as calm as I could and got her out the door. And she called back about a week later and just apologized like crazy and said, well, I knew what she was going through because I'd been through the same thing myself. She wasn't out to get me. She wasn't out to make people's life miserable. her life was miserable and it was all a reflection. And if we take life personally, if I take life personally, then I add on to that. I get mad at her because she's having a bad day and it doesn't help. It doesn't help anything.
Thank you. It's a beautiful example to end on. Learning to be attentive and take it impersonal when people are angry with you. And it sounds like it was a gift you gave her. It was probably very helpful. So thank you. And I encourage you to buy books.